Chair calls the meeting to order. First of all, Representative Murdoch, have you had time to review the minutes of the last meeting?
No, but they look fine, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We'll move the minutes of the last meeting then. Thank you. All in favor? I'll say it louder. All in favor?
Aye.
All right, opposed? Passed. Today we have a number of land spills, and so the chair will move House File 2661, House File 2662, 2877, 3371, 3199, and we'll just hear those and lay them over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Lands Bill. Is there anyone that has anything to testify for or against these bills? Anyone opposed? Yes.
I'm here, but you don't need to. The NR is not a whole story.
Thank you, Representative Olin. Okay. The DNR has no opposition to any of these. In fact, we have a letter which is in your packet that basically has their information regarding these land sales. So if there's no opposition testimony, we'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the lands bill. No, he moved. He went.
Murdoch's going to take care of it.
I can move that.
For Denver?
Yes. If he wasn't here, I can move it.
Okay. The chair moves House File 2663, which will be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Lands Bill. Representative Detmer? I understand you have an amendment as well.
Yes, I have an amendment. And Madam Chair and committees, amendment be A-10-2203.
The author moves the A-10-2203, to which puts this bill in the shape. I'll move the amendment on your behalf to put this bill in the shape you'd like to have it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, House File 2663 is the bill allows Washington County to sell six parcels of tax-forfeited land bordering public waters. The parcels are described, and five parcels totaling 119 acres would be sold to the federal government and managed by the National Park Service. And the sixth parcel of 1.9 acres would be sold to adjacent landowners in the Forest Lake area. And with me, I have Mr. Ken Corbett from Washington County that can maybe give you some more information.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. I guess, first of all, I would ask, is there any opposition to this bill? If not, I think just in the interest of moving this bill along, we will just proceed. And House File 2663, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The chair moves House File 2664 to be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Lands Bill. This is a Rukavina bill, and I understand there's an amendment.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, do you have the 2147 amendment?
We do.
Members, if I could, or do you want me to explain the amendment, Madam Chair, before you move it or what?
That will be fine, just briefly.
What happened is we have an inadvertent trespass, and the bill originally drafted just describes the land that is already owned by the gentleman, and we need this amendment to be able to sell a strip of land that we think is about maybe 150 feet that won't touch the water, the river, to make sure that the person has enough property then to cover where the cabin is located. So that's what it does.
Thank you, Representative. The chair moves the A-10-2147 Rukavina amendment. Is there any opposition to this amendment? If not, all in favor of its adoption?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment adopted.
And Madam Chair, that's the bill, too, and I'm, you know, surprised. Usually the DNR opposes most of my bills, but I'll be giving them the opportunity on this bill later on in the year to oppose it.
Madam Chair.
My amendments on.
Representative Dill.
Well, Jesus was a socialist, so today they're looking down on him.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Rucavina, thank you. We'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion. The chair moves House File 2904 to be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Lands Bill. Representative Hill, thank you for your
Chair,
bill.
Madam Chair, I believe there is an amendment that hopefully members have in their packets.
Yes. The chair moves the 10-2249 Hilty Amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment provides for a restriction on the sale. What is included in this bill is small parcels that are adjacent to public waters, and the amendment, at the suggestion of DNR, provides that they can only be sold to adjacent landowners. I believe with that amendment, there is no objection to the bill. I do have with me Mr. Greg Bernou from the Carlton County Land Office if there are any questions.
Is there any opposition to the amendment? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? In spite of the fact that the committee prior to this did to go over a little bit longer concerning the representative, we will adopt the amendment. To you, Bill. There's anything else.
Madam Chair, it's a simple bill providing for the sale of a couple small parcels in Carlton County. There's no objection to the bill that we're aware of.
Seeing no objection, this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the lands bill.
Thank you very much.
Okay, who's next? Okay, Detmer. Or Demmer. The chair moves, or actually, I guess Representative Murdoch, did you want to move Representative Detmer's bill?
Yes, I would.
That'd be 2935?
Correct, 2935, please, Manager.
And was there an amendment with that one?
Okay. No amendment. This
bill
deals with giving a park back to the city of Orinoco, and it's okay with the DNR and the county, and everybody's on board with it, so no opposition that I know of.
Any opposition to this bill? If not, all in favor? Or rather, this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Lands Bill.
Got to have glasses. Sorry about that.
The chair moves House File 3231 to be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Lands Bill.
Okay, I'd like to move House File. That's what we're doing. House File 3231. Thank you.
That's right.
This would allow for the counties up there. The counties have been working towards a resolution of the land that they have in the boundary waters. And this would allow the exchange of riparian lands that lie within the boundary waters for lands outside the boundary waters that are in their respective counties that have equal value. My advice to the board, to the committee, is to go along with this, because this is a huge problem, whether it be the state of Minnesota or the counties, and they have come to a resolution of it.
Is there anyone that would like to testify in opposition to this bill? All right. If not, House File 3231 is laid over for possible inclusion in the lands bill.
And Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 3230.
To be heard and laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Lands Bill. Is there any testimony for or against? Any opposition?
All right, then to your bill. This has to do with public access on lakes moratorium. Right now, the policy of the state is to continue forward with any lake that is fishable, as determined by the department, to pursue as funds allow, and its property becomes available, to establish public access on those lakes. And with the one of the things that brought this bill forward is the continued spread of invasive species. Now, this bill would not prohibit the department from moving forward with a public access on a lake that already has a public access. So if it had a public access and it was a large lake and they wanted to build another public access or a third one or a fourth one, it wouldn't prohibit that. But what it would do is prohibit until a date certain, I believe it's 2015, it would prohibit them from acquisition, design, and construction of additional public accesses. And this is done until we is in place, hoping that we can come up with a plan to control invasive species. As you are aware, it's thought that the invasive species are traveling in boats, bilge water, traveling on their trailers, traveling in minnow buckets, traveling in just about any way you can imagine traveling, whether it be vegetative or for VHS purposes. And lastly, is we shouldn't be under these budget situations, there's those of us that don't feel we should be acquiring any additional public land except in when absolutely necessary for the purpose of protecting some valuable historic or cultural resource, for example, in the case of a state park. So with that, that's the testimony that I plan to give on the bill. It would not surprise me if we don't hear from the department on this.
Thank you, Representative Dale. Is there anyone that would like to testify in opposition to this? Looks like we have some folks from the DNR.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Ron Potter of the Parks and Trails Division. The department is the primary provider of public waters and lake access in Minnesota, and our mandate is to provide free and adequate access to Minnesota's lakes and rivers. We have established a priority list, and there's approximately 5,500 lakes in Minnesota that are considered fishable lakes. Of those, we have access on about 2,000 of them, and we operate on a willing seller, so there'll go years we've been trying to acquire an access on a lake that doesn't have one, and all of a sudden we have a willing seller, and we need to be able to move when that happens so we can provide that public access for the public. I think as you are all well aware of, Minnesota is probably the number one in boats per capita, and we're number two as far as anglers per capita, and we're number three in the nation for total boats registered. So access to public water is very important to Minnesota residents. And I will let Luke Skinner talk to address the invasives aspect of this.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Luke Skinner. I supervise the DNR's invasive species program. Just a few quick things on prevention of invasive species. It's recognized that watercraft, recreational boats, are a primary source of spread of aquatic invasive species in the state. And they can get there multiple ways. We know that public access is one of them, but also private access as well. We know that boats get launched through private accesses, whether it's homes or commercial. We know that invasive species also spread through other means, such as boats and dock lifts, ones that are used and sold back and forth. And so although if a public access is not on a lake, it's not going to, you can still have a lot of risk of spread of invasive species. We've seen it. We have lakes right now that are infested with no public access. So there's many ways they can get there. The interest, for me, the concern or one of the things is 5 years. I'm not sure what 5 years brings us. If we have 5 years to figure out how to stop the spread, we can certainly help slow them down. But right now, there's no silver bullets to doing it. It's all about people and their behaviors. And those behaviors can be through cleaning their boats, draining waters, which you heard is a key one, live baits, bait buckets, live wells, all those different sources are all ways that invasive species can get into lakes, and they can get in through any source, whether it's a public access or not. So although we do agree that recreational watercraft are a key source, it's not the only one. There's many, many more that we have to deal with. Right now, for our program, we focus on enforcing the laws that are out there, making it illegal to spread aquatic plants. There's current bills that they're trying to address that make some of those laws more easier to enforce. It's right now, it's illegal to transport water from infested waters. It's illegal to transport zebra mussels and all these other species. And right now, it's really about people and their behaviors. We have counties that pull water from lakes for some sources, private or not, and they use them to water down roads. So we have dry hydrants that are taken where water is taken out for firefighting. There's a variety of sources how things can be spread from lake to lake. So our concern is that invasive species is a serious threat. We do want to make sure that we can help prevent the spread across the state. Just want to recognize that there's multiple vectors of how things spread, and although watercraft is one of them, it's not the only one.
Members, are there any questions for either of the testifiers? If not, thank you. If there's another testifier, please come forward. State your name for the record, please.
Greetings. My name is Sean Kellett. I'm representing Anglers for Habitat in this matter. Our group consists of anglers from the bass, muskie, bow fishing, walleye, Lakeshore Association members. We're a very comprehensive organization, and we are not for this bill simply because this would basically be making a lot of private lakes for people. Right now, everyone has rights to the water, and to say that we're going to not allow anyone else to have any additional access to these waters because we're afraid of invasive species, it's unacceptable to us, simply because there's always going to be an invasive species that will not be able to be controlled. And we just don't like where this whole thing is going right now.
Thank you, Mr. Hilly. Any questions for this testifier?
I have a question.
Representative Dill.
Well, first off, you didn't mention the fact that we shouldn't be buying any land. Part of my testimony was that we shouldn't be buying any land in today's tight budgetary times. And you said that it's making private lakes for everyone. You obviously have never been to the Boundary Waters. There's a fair number of lakes up there that are private for a lot of people now because they can't get in there. I mean, most of the people and capable partners can't get in there. People that have aircraft can't get in there. People with boats and motors can't get in there. In fact, if you want to go one step further, you can go to Voyageurs National Park. You can't even land an airplane on the inland waters. You can't run a boat. You can't even take your own boat into many of the lakes in Voyageurs National Parks now because of invasive species. You can't portage a canoe into those lakes because of invasive species. And so to think that we're cutting some new deal here and making people private lakes, this is a matter of trying to do, at least on a temporary basis, give us a stay of execution for possibly some of these lakes that might become infected. Now, I know you're going to disagree with that, but your testimony really doesn't reflect in practicality what's happening out there in other parts of the state in highly sensitive areas. And lastly, as I remember, there's over 2,000 lakes that have public access. Let's see, I'm trying to think how many qualified, and there was about 2,000. Could Mr. Potter, could you come down and tell us how many lakes qualify under your fishing determination? And well, in fact, for the committee's edification, could you tell us how you figure out which ones you're going to have a public access on?
Mr. Potter.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill. The number I previously stated was there's 5,480-some access lakes in Minnesota that have a fishable fish population. Of those, about 2,000 we have public access on now. And how we set our priorities is based upon fish population, be able to sustain that population, the size of the lake, how many accesses are on there now, if any. It's in the criteria that we've used for years, and we work closely with fisheries on setting those priorities.
And Representative
Dill.
And how many lakes in a year would you say average would you be building facilities on of those remaining 3,200.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, that really varies because, as I stated earlier, we operate on a willing seller basis. However, though, in the recent last couple of years, with the land values changing so much, we've had a lot more inquiries for us to acquire land. So I would say that probably there's probably two to three.
All right, so in doing that math, you'd be talking about, at the high end, 15 lakes out of 3,250 lakes that you suggest are fishable, beyond the ones you already have. That seems like an awful small number of lakes to get too wrapped around the axle on when it comes to protecting for invasive species. Now, granted, I understand. I was on the other side of this argument with the National Park Service and said, you know, that an invasive species can come on a seagull leg, for God's sakes. But yet the federal government banned taking your own canoe into those lakes or landing an airplane onto those lakes or running a motor of your motor on their boat. You have to use their equipment because it's been inspected. That's how important this is. And so I can hardly see how that Anglers for Habitat could be in here testifying against a bill that's going to delay, so that we can implement some changes in how we enforce and educate the public for invasive species, number one. Number two, how we evaluate purchasing private land and taking it off the tax rolls, number two, so that we can give public access to lakes that the public could have already bought the land in the open market from someone else and had their own private access into, for the sake of 15 out of 3,250 lakes thereabouts. And that's awful short-sighted. And the last question is, Madam Chair, is how many members does Anglers for Habitat have? And I have no idea. You said you represent it, really, you portrayed it as a, you know, quite a large group.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, I have a few things. Anglers for Habitat,
wait, Madam Chair, I'd like for you to answer my question first, and then you can editorialize later. My question was, how many people does your organization represent?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Dill, currently our board represents about 20 people right now, and we come from areas of all fisheries, all of the major fishing organizations, so we're trying to get the power of everyone's membership together to push some of these issues through. And in regards to the short-sightedness, it's not that we obviously see the harm in the spread of exotic species. What we're more concerned about is this setting a precedent to extend and extend and extend and extend this moratorium on new bodies of water and access, where this is basically the first step in what could possibly be a never-ending cycle of not opening up new bodies of water. That is our concern more than anything, Representative Dill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dill.
I think it's well recorded and documented at this hearing that this author of this bill doesn't have that legislative intent at all. Mm-hmm. That's all I have to say. Like Forrest Gump, that's all I've got to say about that.
Thank you, Representative Dill. Are there any further comments? Anyone else that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Hearing none, this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then somebody can take it out. Yeah. All right. Representative Dill, would you like to move your bill, House File 3051?
Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 3051, recommended to pass, and referred to the Committee on Environment Policy and Oversight, and adopt the amendments. Are we doing that as one amendment at the end? Okay.
To your bill.
problem with having too many here tonight. Had to find it first.
What's the number again?
3051.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. House File 3051 is what is commonly known as the statewide lands bill, and has many sections in it, upwards of 35 sections that affects lands all across the state, north to south, east to west. And frankly, the easiest way to run through this quickly is to have Ms. Lewis come down and run through it quite briefly, and then if there are any questions, they can be asked specifically of Ms. Lewis or myself, and then if someone would like to testify for or against a particular section, then maybe we could entertain that. So with me, I have Ms. Lewis from the Department of Lands and Minerals, Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you. Ms. Lewis, please identify yourself for the record.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kathy Lewis, Assistant Director, Lands and Minerals Division, DNR. The bill before you today has several sections concerning some policy issues and some technical amendments before we get into the actual land sale parcels. Section 1 of the bill would provide the DNR with authority to purchase lands within or adjacent to existing designated state parks if the land ownership would enhance the park's recreational value. The DNR could then amend the boundaries of the state park using a procedure which is a commissioner's order and publication of the state register. Section 2 is a technical change to recognize the McCarthy Beach State Park is actually in two counties. Section 3 concerns the Hill Annex Mine State Park, and this is to help clarify legislative intent. We have basically three legislative directions for the Hill Annex Mine State Park. One is it's school trust land, and our direction is to generate revenue from school trust land. When Hill Annex Mine State Park was established by the legislature, the direction was that mining would be allowed in the state park. And the third direction is that this is a state historic site, and state statute directs that we look at preserving and mitigating state historic sites. And so there's a conflict that exists in the law. We have on the Hill Annex Mine State Park, it's a historic site for mining. There's stockpiles on the property. We have a company that would like to lease the stockpiles. It would generate over $9 million revenue to the school trust fund. There's also taconite resource here. And the question is, should we be going through a process of studying and identifying how to mitigate adverse impacts and for the historic site, or proceed with mining under the law? Section 4 is similar to Section 1, gives the DNR authority to purchase or sell lands within or adjacent to existing state forest, and then to modify the boundaries of the state forest. Section 5 of the bill is a technical change, recognizing that state forest lands can be acquired with or without a mineral reservation provision. Section 6 of the bill, you may have seen in other bills, this is providing authority for the Commissioner of Natural Resources to purchase lands within the boundaries of the Lake Vermilion State Park for up to $18 million. Section 7 of the bill proposes to expand the boundaries of four state parks and they're Forestville Mystery Cave, Judge Magni, Split Rock Lighthouse, and Teta Gooch. Total acreage is 708 acres. Section 8 of the bill proposes to remove parcels from the state park system. There's seven parks involved. The total of removal would be 176.89 acres. Section 9 of the bill is for Lyons State Forest, and we propose to add 640 acres to the forest. Most of that is currently school trust land. There's 140 that we'd like to acquire that would be become acquired forestry land. Section 10 of the bill concerns the requirement in state law that state agencies sell $6.44 million worth of state-owned land. This is the fifth year of the law. Now it's been extended twice. The law provides that if it's not sold by June 30th of 2011, money is removed from the state budget, state agency's budget, in order to meet the requirement. The state agencies and the DNR have been working on this. We've sold 48 parcels, but overall, the state agencies have $2.5 million to go. And we look at the current real estate market and the buyers, and we say it's going to be very difficult to meet this requirement. So what Section 10 of the bill does, it says it allows the commissioner to sell for less than appraised value. We think we might find some buyers in those instances. The remainder of the bill concerns primarily the sale of specific parcels of land. There's 25 parcels involved for a total of 592 acres. There'd be 8 direct sale parcels and 17 through public sale. There's also provision for allowing a land exchange where property was acquired with bonding dollars, and there's also a parcel where the land has been conveyed through the state through abolishment of a Rushford Area Drainage Conservancy District, but no state agency has been identified who actually manages those properties. And I obviously can provide specifics as to any parcel it's in those sections if any of the members would like to do so. So that's a quick summary of the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Are there any questions from the members on any of this testimony? Representative Dill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you go over, Ms. Lewis, Section 1 again, please, regarding the state park boundary changes? And tell us what that means in practicality.
Ms. Lewis.
If you would.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. What Section 1 does is says, currently the DNR, when it's acquiring land for state parks, can only acquire lands that's within the boundaries of the existing state parks. And, of course, if we're purchasing them, we need the appropriation from the legislature to do so. What this law would do is saying the DNR could purchase lands within or adjacent to the existing state parks without having to come to the legislature first and change the boundary of the state park. What you see in Section 7 of the bill is an example of how we have to come to the legislature, we change the boundary of the park, and then we proceed to acquisition. In this case, we could proceed actually to acquire the land, and then by commissioner's order and publication of the state register, officially change the boundary of the state park to accommodate the area. This does not create brand new state parks. We are still limited to the fact that they have to be adjacent to or in the proximity of an existing state park, and it also has to say that the lands have to be contributing to the recreational value of the state parks. It is giving the commissioner some more discretion, similar to what the commissioner has for aquatic management areas and wildlife management areas.
Thank you. Representative Dill.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. What has been the past interpretation of within proximity of a state park? And secondly, is my second part of that question, could the commissioner use this to purchase land to buffer a state park from such an activity like hunting? Because it would, let's just say, I'm not saying that it will, I'm just giving this as an example, and I'm not alluding that it should, but let's say that there was a particular piece of land that was very popular for hunting, but it were near, either adjacent to or in the proximity of a state park, and the commissioner thought that it would enhance the recreational value of the state park itself, by buying that property and then restricting hunting on that. Would that be possible under this language?
Ms. Lewis.
Madam Chair, to your first question, the word proximity, that is used in statute. One example, I believe, is 9245, which talks about waters issues. And so proximity has to be within, it should be bordering, or it should be maybe a corner touching, or it should be very, very close. But we talked about whether we should put a distance here, and we ended up picking the word proximity as an art that we recognize in other statutes. As to the hunting question, the test that the commissioners provided is it will contribute to the recreational value of the state park, and the commissioner is dedicated to managing the state park system for the purposes of the state park system to provide the attributes. And so you would first have the test of does it fit the attributes of the state park system and the purpose that's created for the state park system. Could it impact hunting? Depends on the characteristics. So I don't think it's an absolute yes or no, but there could be instances that would arise where there'd be some hunting properties that could end up in a state park.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Representative Dill, did you have another question?
Well, comment? I think that's about as good an answer as you could have given me. I'm thinking of the same line of questioning on Section 4. I want to make sure for the record that this Section 4 has nothing to do with state parks. It only has to do with state forests. I mean, it says that in this DNR policy fact sheet, but I just want to confirm with you on the record that this is not a state park provision, but a state forest provision, two very different animals.
Ms. Lewis.
Madam Chair, yes, I confirm that this is only for state, Section 4 only applies to the state forests.
Thank you for the clarification. Are there any other or any questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Dill.
I do know that there's going to be testimony on Section
3.
The Hill Annex section, what is that section?
Section 3.
From the Historical Society, State Historic Preservation Office.
Very good. Would someone like to come down at this time to testify on that issue?
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Fox. I'm the Minnesota Historical Society's Deputy Director for Programs. I'm here to testify against Section 3 of this bill and ask that you either remove its language from the bill or consider alternative language. I want to be clear at the beginning, the Society and the State Historic Preservation Office are not certainly not opposed to additional mining of iron ore resources at this park. We simply ask that a plan to do so takes into account documenting the resource and the park visitor's interpretive experience. We feel that Section 3 sets an extremely bad precedent by eliminating an important review process for cultural resources for a specific project, that is to say, the Hill Annex Mine State Park. As the previous testifier pointed out, this is an instance where there are competing priorities. Maximizing proceeds from the school trust funds, school trust fund lands, preservation of state park resources, and preservation of an historical cultural resource. The competing priorities were acknowledged in the 1988 law, which states the intent was to create a state park to interpret and provide the public with an opportunity to view and experience natural iron ore open pit mining operations as conducted on Minnesota's historic iron ranges, while also contemplating future mining from the park. This section and the previous testimony suggest that these three priorities are somehow mutually incompatible, and the resolution that's proposed in this bill is to favor one over the other, that is to say, by eliminating the existing review process. Under Minnesota law, the Department of Natural Resources has a statutory mandate to protect cultural resources because, under Minnesota law, cultural resources and historic resources are included in the definitions of natural resources in many, many places in the statutes including various areas of environmental law. The department does an excellent job in many, many instances to preserve historic resources, but Section 3 of the bill seeks to simply eliminate their responsibility in statute. Again, we believe a bad precedent. We've had conversations in the past with DNR on this project as recently as last November, and we were surprised to learn of the inclusion of this language in the bill recently. Last Friday, we had a conference call with various staff members at DNR, and we spoke this morning with Assistant Commissioner Meyer, suggesting some optional language to replace Section 3. We wait to hear back from DNR as to their reply or their take on this alternative language. But we feel that with some additional conversation, we can find a solution to move this process forward without creating the precedent of removing an important safeguard for our historic and cultural properties that are now written in statute and have been there for many years.
Thank you,
happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from members? any other questions or comments regarding this particular testimony from the author?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is going to leave this committee and is being recommended to pass and sent to the full Environment Policy Committee. And it was just today at the steps of the House chambers that the two opposing forces met and language was exchanged. And so what I want to do, what would be the author's intention, to move ahead with the bill as stated in Section 3, and that between the time that we meet in Environment Policy, that we try and craft a resolution to this if possible. I wanted to give some additional information to the committee that on this site, on this particular section of land, which is school trust land, which I'm certain most of you know that is dedicated for revenue producing type things for our schools, whether they be the university trust or the K-12 trust, there is about $6 to $7 million worth of iron ore that was at one time rejected as being too low a quality of iron ore to make iron, to make taconite pellets from, or iron for that matter. And it's stockpiled there. But a new technology has come forward. It's called magnetation. Totally new technology. It's not making iron from raw hematite. It's not making taconite. It's new. It's going back through, in many instances, the reject material and making new, and there's a big value to that. As well, underneath this land, underneath this deposit of reject material, stockpile, is also a considerable amount of taconite that will likely be used by one of the neighboring mines, maybe even Esser Steel, which will be Minnesota's first steel plant. So this is very, very important to the income stream to the school trust. And I don't think that the Historical Society has a problem with mining it and getting that value out of the land. They just would like to have the historical aspects of that land reviewed and potentially preserved or something along those lines. And so what I'm going to ask to do is to go ahead and pass it as is, and then we're going to try and figure something out between now and then, if possible.
Thank you, Representative Dale. We'll look forward to the results of your collaboration.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Fox.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I understand there are some additional amendments. The A10-2261 has been pulled at this point due to the fact that there were some technical difficulties simply with the printing of the amendment. And so rather than address it at this time with the difficulties, that amendment could be put on in the environment policy.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay, then, Madam Chair, I have an oral amendment. I'd like to delete Section 1 of the bill.
Representative Dill.
All right. I want to delete Section 1 of the bill because I want to make sure I know exactly what this does and how it could be applied in the future. And I'm not saying that in the next committee stop we won't put it back in, but in this, at this time, I'd like to delete section one.
Any comments or questions? If not, all in favor of deleting section one?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
Madam Chair, I have the A10-2256 amendment, which is the Lake County amendment. And that is something that we have negotiated between the DNR and Lake County regarding a land exchange in Section 10. And I believe that there is a peace in the valley on this. And with that, I'd ask that the committee support the adoption. You can mark that off the bingo. Peace in the valley. And it's a win-win. And it's another tool in the toolbox. So I'd like to have an affirmative vote on this.
Thank you, Representative Dale. I think you had that encapsulated rather nicely. Is there any discussion to this amendment? If not, all in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment's carried. I believe Representative Dale would now like to move to amend the following bills. House File 3051, House File 2661, 2662, 2877, 3371, 3199, 2663, 2664 as amended, 2904 as amended, 2935, 3231, and House File 3230.
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Very well. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill is amended and passed.
What? What? Okay.
All right. All in favor of passage of the bill on to Environment Policy and Oversight Committee? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The bill is passed. We'll take a 3-minute break.
Recess,
I should say.
Thanks. And we're waiting for Mark to come back.
Okay, so we got here making the list there.
Never knew there was so many nasty bits in this state.
Boom! Oh, the fish blowed up.
I think we got
one. One shot. Why waste your time? How
do
you get that?
Do you get the turkey in there?
I didn't apply.
All right, we'll call the meeting back to order. Representative Falk, would you like to move House File 3349?
I would.
Okay, for possible inclusion laid over to the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill. Representative Falk, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is a small bill. It allows the quartering of deer, and in that process, you wouldn't have to leave the head attached for identification purposes. Just speaking with Commissioner Meyer, and we're working on some language, but I do have Mr. Tom Kelleher here on behalf of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association that could walk you through the more detailed parts of what we're trying to accomplish.
Welcome, Mr. Kelleher. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here on the behalf of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, and I thank you for moving the bill of Representative Fox a little forward. I have a time constraint this evening, but I'll be back. This basically came across some of our board members hunting the Boundary Waters Canoe Area in the Concon lands, which are sort of northwest of Bemidji and Jay Cook State Park, and those sorts of, you know, very outback, sort of hiked into the woods 4 or 5 miles to hunt deer. Some of them would like to not have to bring the deer's head back out with them, which is what the current law says. Current law is allowed for the quartering of deer for, I believe, 6 or 8 years, maybe a little bit longer than that. So what we'd like to do is to be able to leave the head in the woods, except for when there's an antler point restriction, which I understand that, well, under an expired current law, for Zone 3A last season, to add the 2 days back to that period of time, there were a bunch of restrictions placed primarily by the Senate but became law on no party hunting, had to have been a 4-point antler restriction, and a couple other criteria which I can't remember off the top of my head. The Senate has decided to put that language back in the bill for this year, which would be for the 2010 deer hunting season. So there'd be one area where antler point restrictions would occur. So the DNR would like to basically say, I'm doing this right from the bill, Mr. Chair, on line 1.8, where it says the animal's head must remain attached to one of the quarters, they'd like to say for zones where an antler point restrictions exist, the animal's head must remain attached to one of the quarters. And then on line 1.8, you would unstrike the animal's head and add the animal's head or genitalia. So you'd add or genitalia to current law. And I'd be happy to stand for any questions on that subject, Mr. Chair. And I guess one fast thing, I've never tried to field dress a deer and leave the genitalia on. I understand that in Canada for moose hunting, it is allowed, if you remove the moose's head, to leave the genitalia on. So it can be done in a field dress situation. And I think part of the issue, just real fast, is that, you know, quartering a deer is not an easy thing, especially in the field. So it's not going to be a lot of people that are going to be doing this. It's just for very examples, as I said, when you're 3, 4, 5 miles back in the woods, you're hunting alone or you're hunting with someone else, that to bring out a full deer carcass is difficult. And I'll segue to Mr. Meyer, if that's okay with the chair.
Well, I see Mr. Meyer has joined us. Would you like to give us your 30 cents worth?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. We do appreciate working with the Deer Hunters Association, Representative Falk, on this issue. The main thing, our Deer Hunting Management Subcommittee is talking about this right now, in particular in the BWCA, but we've been working with MDHA on this issue since the past week in the Senate to address our concerns dealing with genitalia, which we do need for identification, and then also in some areas where there may be or are antler point restrictions, we need to make sure that that head of the animal is attached to one of the quarters until it's registered to verify that it is a legally taken animal. So I think we're getting there. I don't know if we have the language perfect, but or we can certainly work on this language as you progress the bill as well.
Questions of Representative Falk, Mr. Kelleher, or Assistant Commissioner Meyer? If we're going to do an amendment somewhere, you know, obviously we're going to need it for the next committee. In fact, what I think we'll do is we're going to lay this over. We won't include it in the bill, leaving here, and we'll put it in as an amendment, your language, when we get to the next committee, and we'll say that we've vetted this in this committee and that the solution is before us in the next committee, which would be Representative Eakin's committee.
And Mr. Chair, to that point, I mean, I think we do have agreement on the language too. It's just that for technical purposes of time that we weren't able to get it put before us. So we appreciate that, and we can work with that.
I can appreciate that, and with that, we'll lay. Unless there's questions by the members, being none, we'll lay the bill over. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cornish, you're going to be presenting the decoy bill. So Representative Cornish would like to move the 2906 for possible inclusion. And this is a Hackbarth bill, but he's not available, so Representative Cornish is going to explain the bill. To the bill, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 2906 authored by Hackbarth is basically years ago you couldn't leave your decoys out overnight. Way back when, it must have been 15 years ago or so, they changed the law where you could leave the decoys out overnight. But it's become problematic, and the way you can leave them out now under current law is if you own the waters adjacent to the you own the land adjacent to the waters where you're going to put the decoys out, and there is not natural vegetation growing in the water to sufficiently partially conceal a hunter. So what it's allowed people to do basically is take hundreds and hundreds of feet of shoreline, sometimes almost a quarter mile, where it's void of the vegetation and owned by the person on land there, and put their decoys out and basically take up large stretches of public water for hunting, because nobody, even if there's existing weeds out further than the shore, wants to hunt out in front of a bunch of people. And it's taken opportunity away for a lot of people that want to hunt. And so Representative Hackbarth wants to bring it back to where it used to be. And Mr. Chair, I think I have an amendment here. Would you want me to?
We have an amendment?
I think it's the A1 amendment.
All right. Representative Cornish moves the 2906 A1.
Mr. Chair and members, what this amendment would do would make an exception to that. You couldn't leave your decoys out anymore overnight unless the decoys are in waters completely surrounded by private land and there's no public access to the water. It's kind of a common sense amendment basically saying that if you own the land around the completely around the lake and there is no public access to the water, then who cares, basically. And so it will allow somebody that's got a landlocked lake to leave their decoys out. And that's the bill with the amendment, Mr. Chair. It gives more opportunity to the general public. And if people want to hunt on private land, they can always get in a boat and go out and find some vegetation like everybody else instead of taking up large areas of the land or the water in front of their land. The theory behind this is, I think, Representative Hackbarth, is you do own the land, but just because you do, you shouldn't be able to take up that huge blocks of water and take the opportunity away from somebody that might want to hunt.
All
Questions by the members? No questions, Representative McNamara? I'm starting to learn the committee pretty well. I know where these questions come from. Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, can you give an example of what we're fixing, how it's used inappropriately, or what we would think may be inappropriately sure. today, and how this will fix
it? I had a big circle here. Pretend this paper is a lake, and if you own land around these two sides of the lake and there isn't a lot of vegetation there, you could put out your string of decoys completely around these two sides here and leave them overnight, thereby preempting those spots for hunting just because you own the land. What this bill would do would be take away that opportunity for the landowner to do that, and he or she would have to come out and hunt the lake and the existing vegetation like everybody else. You couldn't cordon off this whole area. And right now, if you own the land adjacent to the water, and there's not vegetation sufficient to partially conceal a hunter, then you can leave your decoys out. And the partially conceal a hunter, there's been court opinions on that over the years, and it just kind of convolutes everything because one blade of grass or 10, you know. So this just cleans it up, gives everybody the same opportunity on the lake.
Representative McNamara.
And just to clarify, Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, if two private parties own short land around the lake, that would be considered private land. That would be up to them to work together to do their deal, whatever, but they would not need to worry about, that would not be considered public just because there's two parcels. Isn't that the way you'd read this?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, yeah, the way I read it, they are completely surrounded by private land. There's no public access. Yes, so if it's 10 neighbors, but it's private land and there's no public access to the water, you could leave your decoys out.
Okay, let's adopt the A1, the 2906A1 to get the bill in the shape the author wants it. On favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. Now, further questions on the bill? Being none, anyone here to testify for or against the bill? There being none, we'll lay the bill over for possible inclusion as amended.
Thank you.
And now we're doing this one. Okay, now Representative Purcell, House File 3227. Representative Purcell moves House File 3227 for possible inclusion in the Game and Fish Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So moved.
And before we get started on this, we're going to, when we have the testimony, because we have a significant number of people that are going to be testifying, we're going to allow 3 minutes per testifier. Maximum, and at 3 minutes we will be done with each testifier. That does not pertain to Representative Purcell, however.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're very kind. Members.
My heart's falling right out.
I can see that. just in the notion of time, there are two testifiers that will not be testifying in favor, as I understand it at this time. We're trying to limit the time here. Mr. Chair, members, House File 3227 is a simple rulemaking bill for to remove the spearing ban on Cass Lake, which is a lake that is immediately adjacent to the town, the city of Cass Lake, and the ban was put into place in about 1988, and was renewed. It was put in place for 10 years and was renewed in approximately 98. We're going to hear some testimony today on different aspects of this type of fishery management, and I just want to preface my comments out of the gate here saying that I've had the pleasure of working with the state DNR folks on a number of fishery issues over the years, and some of them going on at this time up in my district, and we'll continue to work on these, and my time working with the DNR on fishery issues goes back to 1982, actually, and I had the pleasure of working with a gentleman named Dennis Shupp, and I don't know if any of the folks here remember him, but he was a head statistician for fisheries for the state DNR for many years, and he retired some time ago. And our work together was on Mille Lacs Lake, and I'd be happy to expound. I'm bringing this up because we're going to hear some testimony about fishery statistics today. And I've spent some time on fishery statistics, being a scientist myself. I can only tell you that I wish fishery statistics were like the chemistry statistics that we had to do in the laboratory, where you could get more precision and accuracy with them. But you just can't do it. You can't get the data the way you can do in a controlled laboratory. So I bring this up because there's uncertainty, significant uncertainty in many regards with statistics that we're able to garner from test nets, from fike nets, or other creel census or other aspects. So trying to determine fishery populations. At this time, I would like to introduce two gentlemen that are going to testify here. We have the mayor of Cass Lake and Mr. Wayne Bond, also from Cass Lake, and I don't know, Mr. Mayor, if you would like to start out.
Welcome, Mayor.
Mr. Chairman, committee, I thank you for your time. I know you have a very busy schedule, so I'll make it brief. The city of Cass Lake, if you're familiar where it's located, it's about 14 miles west of Bemidji. We have a population of 813 people. We have an unemployment rate of 14% to 16%. The average median income in Cass Lake is about $20,000. Poverty rate is probably about 14% or 17%, right? We have a property tax base of 28%. And yet we, in the city of Cass Lake, have to provide the same services as any other community, but with a much, much smaller tax base. And we've done quite well. The Cass Lake City Council in January was approached. They passed a resolution to support lifting the spaying ban in the city of Cass Lake. And I am an enrolled member. Two council members are enrolled members, but yet to lift the spaying ban passed unanimously with the three council members. Two council members are non-tribal members. And the community itself has turned out, and they stood united once for an issue that very rarely happens, where the community all came together to have the spearing ban lifted in hopes that it promotes the economy in Cass Lake. There's at least 100 businesses that signed letters of support to lift the spearing ban. We have other organizations that came forward also. And we hope that we can increase our economic development by eliminating the spearing ban. There are other communities that don't have a spearing ban, and if I read correctly, the state did allow spearing to non-residents just recently, I believe. And we have to consider, you know, we have non-residents that come into the city, come into Minnesota and spear, but we have residents of Minnesota that are not allowed to spear. Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe verbally came out in support of lifting the ban, but they haven't been able to have a council meeting to submit a letter of support. But I'm sure that my friend Chairman LaRose, Archie LaRose, would support lifting the ban. Like I said, the ban is not covered by the ban can still spear. I can still spear. Two other council members can still spear. But if they're not band members, they cannot spear. The ban, when it was originally put in place, I believe, only pertained to muskies, not to northern pike. Cass Lake is a natural lake. There's no stocking in the lake by the DNR whatsoever. It's all a natural lake. It's a beautiful lake. And for the Senate committee, we had a hearing with Senator Shadgray. His comment was, is it stocked? The comment was no. The question was, why wasn't it stocked? Whether stocking is going to help the lake or not, I don't know.
Okay, well, thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. And who's up next?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Wayne Bond, and I represent the Cass Lake Initiative for Spearing, and myself as a lifelong resident of the city of Cass Lake and a spear fisherman in the area for the bulk of my life. Very few people were more dedicated or passionate about that sport than my father, and I spent many hours in a dark house with him. And it was there that I learned to do this, to participate in this sport myself. One of the fundamental flaws that is from the outset in this is that one of the basis for this experiment was the concept that somehow dark house spear fishermen were killing muskies, either intentionally because they're criminals or accidentally because they're ignorant and unable to discern the difference between muskies and northerns in the water. In a lot of sports that you participate in, deer hunting, pheasants, turkeys, you have to be able to identify the gender of the game that you're shooting. In ducks, you not only have to be able to identify the gender, but the species in full flight before daylight. This is something that's very easy to do in a dark house. We're not ignorant. We are educated in the difference between the species, and this is fundamentally an issue of education and enforcement. It is now and always has been illegal to spear muskies in the state of Minnesota. If somebody is committing a crime, they should be prosecuted. That crime is on the books. Treating all of us as though we are criminals does nothing to protect muskies. I'm sure, you know, Representative Cornish, with his experience in law enforcement, can tell you that a very small percentage of the population commits a very large portion of the crimes. And those people are not deterred by laws that ban them from that illegal activity. And that most honest and ethical people will abide by the law, not because of a fear of the penalties, but simply because it's the right thing to do. Currently, members of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe are eligible to spear on Cass Lake. The only people that can't are people who are not members of the band. All that we are asking of this committee is to remove this restriction, to no longer treat us as if we are ignorant or as though we are criminals, but simply to restore our rights to participate in a sport that is lawful in the state of Minnesota and to allow us to do so in a manner which is reflective of the bulk of people that participate as honest and ethical sportsmen. I thank you for your time.
Questions of the testifier? Being none, Dean Phillips.
I think he's going to pass, Mr. Chair.
I believe we gave you a list, Mr. Chair, of four people that would be testifying.
Okay, here we got the list right here. Okay, Tim Spreck.
Mr. Chair, just if I may briefly, just so nobody gets confused here, we've heard some testimony about the fact that tribal members can spear and non-Indians can't. This lake, Cass Lake, is fully within the Leech Lake Indian Reservation, and that's how the status of that has been determined by treaty rights.
Mr. Spreck.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, my name is Tim Spreck. I'm president of the Minnesota Dark House Angling Association. I'm going to move through my comments here, try not to be redundant so that we don't waste anybody's time this afternoon. My job today is to talk to you about the study that was used to initially ban spearing on Cass Lake. In 1988, the DNR closed Cass Lake to spearing under a 10-year evaluation program, and at the end of that 10-year cycle, there was a study conducted, and after that point, Cass Lake was permanently closed. Some of the interesting things about the study is that we find that there was no change in pike population, so the removal of spearing on that lake did not change the population of pike. They did, however, show that there was an increase in the average size of muskies. Now, the interesting thing about that is, and when we dig deeper into that particular study, we actually find that it was flawed in several interesting and completely different ways, which sheds a lot of dispersion on that particular study. Number one concern here is that after the study was conducted, the data was actually guarded. It was not provided to DNR biologists for review. Second thing, nobody that conducted the study was actually willing to sign it. To this day, the study has not been signed. Nobody's taking credit for it. And our contention is that because of bad science, that this study was not signed. One fisheries biologist ended up losing his job over this because he was trying to do the right thing. Later on, DNR officials acknowledged in the media that the conclusions of the study were incorrect, but nothing was done about it, and the ban continued in full effect. The other thing to remember is that all future lakes were based on this particular study. 26 lakes are currently closed to spearing now because of the action that was taken on Cass Lake and what we contend to be a flawed study. Here are some specifics about the study. Number one, an angler diary of a known anti-spearing pro-muskie angler was used to show increase in the average size of muskies after the initial ban. In our opinion, not very scientific. Number two, fall electrofishing data was used even though there was no pre-ban data to compare the count to. Number three, spring netting data was used even though there was no pre-ban data to compare the counts to. When they were doing the spring netting, they had some trouble with their figures. The numbers weren't showing what they wanted to, so what they did was they moved the nets into the spawning beds to incorporate the larger size of the big spawning females into the data. Once again, we have trouble with the science. Number four, taxidermist surveys were used to show the size of muskies that were being taken. We have no idea who these taxidermists were, if the fish even came from the lake, or even if that these people even existed.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Geschel next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Roger Geschel. I'm a member of the Minnesota Dark House and Angling Association. At the time of this ban, I was state president. And what I'd like to talk about is what happened. I do have a set of things for you, Mr. Chairman, that you can read because I won't get to all of it.
Thank you.
At the time of the of this ban, when this happened, there was a call made to me from one of our people up in the Cass Lake area that had told me that a senior or a biologist up there was fired. And we just checked on that and found out. His name was Stephen Bowe. And I've been in contact with Stephen, and I just want to read a couple of emails. He states that the study was so unscientific that he objected to it, and that the study was never signed by anyone, which is usually a requirement. No one would sign this because it wasn't a true statement. So he was terminated because of this. In a couple of emails, which in your this that I gave you, Mr. Chairman, you'll see these. But one of them was Minnesota Fishery DNR officials recently added. This was in March of 2003. Minnesota DNR Fisheries officials recently added 67 more waters to the existing list of about 40 with special regs restricting the harvest of northern pike. The fisheries officials expect the move to improve the quality, size structure of the northern pike population, but there is very little evidence to support this optimism. It's more likely that for many of the waters listed, the special regulations will simply reduce recreational opportunities without any noticeable benefit. And remember, Steve Bowe was a large lake specialist for the Department of Natural Resources Fisheries up in Bemidji. I have not seen any case histories of waters with special regs for northern pike that have clearly achieved the improved size structure. If there were any, I would expect the DNR officials to be showcasing them. Among the 40-some waters previously designated, surely there must be some success stories. In far too many cases, the DNR has poorly designated or carried out evaluations of special regs and thus are unable to show any changes. Cass Lake and more recently Steiger Lake are two examples that come to mind. Why not focusing on doing a good job of evaluating waters with existing special regs rather than adding more lakes? To fish in Minnesota, you must pay for a license and pay excise tax on your fishing equipment. Using those dollars to diminish fishing opportunities without any clear benefit is wrong. Before implementing any special regs that cover such a large number of lakes, the DNR should prepare a document written proposal that can be reviewed and criticized by the public, various organizations, and other fisheries professionals, and so on.
Thank you, Mr.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Snitker, Mr. Snitker.
Thank you, Chairman Dill. My name is Kirk Snitker. I provided a written statement and some documentation to supporting my testimony. I'm a volunteer coordinator with Sportsmen for Responsible Muskie Management. We were created when the DNR had an ill-advised plan to stock muskies on Gull Lake, which eventually did not happen. Our organization's goal is not to defeat muskie fishing or its interests. Our goal is to gather information and shed light on muskie-related resource management issues. I'm a member of Muskies, Inc. I attended the separate Senate hearing on this matter last week and did not testify, but I heard views that were opposed to this bill, and many of the views were not backed up with the facts. They argue that muskies will be speared, but they have nothing to show that, whether or not they're being speared, whether or not they're being speared at all or even nominally. When we hear this with this charge, we ask, who is killing muskies? Well, let's say for a minute that in one particular lake, in an annual year, let's say a couple of muskies are actually speared, let's say five of them. But if we have a mortality rate, which is even reported in Muskies, Inc. magazine, which is provided to you, mortality rate of 10 anywhere from 10 to 30%, if 1,000 muskies are killed in that year, it's the muskie anglers, those that are fishing muskies, that killed 100 fish. It's not the spears. In one muskie tournament in 2008, 156 fish were caught and released. If you apply even a low mortality rate of 10%, that's 15 fish are being killed. I doubt in that lake that 15 fish or anything close to that, if at all, were killed by spears. On the issue of mortality and predation on walleyes or other game fish, I've provided in my information that there are studies in other states and studies that are ignored by the state of Minnesota and the folks that are muskie proponents about the impact that muskies can have on sport and sport fish and the forage base. One biologist wrote, I conclude that predation from moderate to high density muskie populations is having a severe impact on sport and forage fish populations in many lakes in Wisconsin. In this state, I believe we're treating muskies as if they were some kind of an endangered species. It's hardly the case. We have plenty of them. They're a beautiful fish, and I think they're an asset to the state. However, 35% of the waters in the state of Minnesota are now managed for muskies. That means 35% of the waters in the state are now being stocked with muskies. Also, there was a study this last year that studied on walleyes, and the conclusion of that study was 8.5% of the population in the state of Minnesota actually targets muskies in any one year. But yet we have 35% of our waters. It's a great resource, but I think that the point is that there's a limited resource, limited dollars, and we're already focusing well on muskies' interests in this state. We stock 35% of the waters, but we ban spearing for them. We ignore the fact that catch and release practices are killing muskies more than spears. We've done enough for the muskie interests in the state. In this state, we have a constitutional protection to protect the right to hunt and fish. All constitutional protections, as you lawyers and non-lawyers know, that they need to be that there's certain curbs and restrictions on constitutional protections when there's certain public government interests or public interests that are compelling. In this particular matter, I see no government compelling interest. Thank you.
That's all we've got. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you for time.
Mr. Underhill.
Thank you, Chairman Dill, committee members. John Underhill, Minnesota Muskie Alliance. I've heard some kind of alarming things here. There's a lot of corruption in the field staff, I guess. Also that the science of how we manage our lakes is flawed. But I'd like to get back to the point. And the point is there is poaching and spearing of muskies in Minnesota. It's happening. We're catching fish that have the marks. And I've got a pile of photos there you can send around to you. I can email them as well. The options that I've heard for making this acceptable are stocking fish or creating huge penalties for people that are caught spearing muskies. The possibility of catching someone spearing a muskie is probably a little closer to zero than one. They're speared, taken off in the hole. They're never brought out, thrown on the ice. COs can no longer open up the door. They have to knock and be let in. So the opportunity is leaning towards the poacher in this case. There was enough of it going on in Cass Lake to initiate this. That lake is, as we've heard, is a very special lake. It's a beautiful lake. It doesn't have to be stocked. Walleye, northern pike, muskie, nothing is stocked in that lake. And that's pretty rare in this day and age, and that saves all of us licensed buyers a lot of money. And now we're talking about stocking the lake to allow spearing, but then all of us have to pay for that. This is an ugly issue. It's always been an ugly issue, and it's not going to get any better. The more we push this thing, there's 50 plus game refuges and sanctuaries in Minnesota, and these 26 lakes represent trophy and brood lakes, and there should be a few lakes, as was mentioned earlier, with another issue where we can protect and take care of these lakes with special regulations into a higher degree. I think the area should promote the ice fishing and promote their fishery. They've got a wonderful fishery, northern pike, walleye, muskie. It's a great place to go and a great place to fish. It's a great lake, but there are social issues involved in accomplishing that as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your testimony. And, Mr. Kelly. Welcome again.
Welcome, Mr. Chair, and esteemed members of the council here. It's really sad that this legislation had to come up. I mean, we as Esauset anglers, muskie fishermen, pike fishermen, and dark house anglers have a forum for addressing issues like this with the DNR called the Esauset Workshop. I've passed around a very limited copy of the Esauset Management Program. I never got around to emailing that to you. I will do that tonight. Basically, this is a 54-page or 57-page work or document that sees to the management of the Esauset, Minnesota Esauset Natural Resource. And in that, concessions were made on all sides of the Esauset issues. Muskies Inc. and the muskie groups conceded not to look for additional spearing bans, and no additional lifts of the existing spearing bans were also part of that bill, if you would. But this issues like this were supposed to be brought up in this group. Cass Lake was not brought up in this group, and quite frankly, it's just turned really ugly. One of the people who testified this past Monday in the Senate bill, his job, if you look, I have a letter that's sent out by Mr. Cochran. Mr. Cochran had his job threatened by one of the members, if not several of the members, in this room today. I can't identify who those people are, as there may be legal repercussions to that. And the police actually came to him and said that they're worried about his personal safety. This is an issue that was long dead. That's all this is doing, is peeling the scar off an old wound. There's many, many, you know, statistical and biological reasons not to lift this. The cliff notes are is the dark house anglers attack the largest pike in the system. When the largest pike in the system are gone, the smaller pike thrive and basically take over that system. When you have a large number of small pike, natural reproduction of muskies and walleyes is greatly retarded. And as was stated before, Cass is not stocked for any species. So by allowing this type of harvest of large pike, we are probably going to have issues long-term with the health of this fishery. And I'll be short for you this time.
All right. Thank you very much. Troy Zaliski.
Thank you.
Welcome. You state your name for the committee, please, and who you represent.
Troy Zulski, president of the Twin Cities Muskies Inc. chapter. Pleased to have your time, chairman and committee. First, the reason why this is being proposed is a change in the economic impact to help Cass Lake. I ask, has there been a study to show what kind of economic impact there will be up there? And we're talking about a group of 14,000 anglers that currently, as in previous Billy stated, they got 2,000 lakes they can go spear on. So it isn't a limit of resources out there. There's plenty of opportunity. That's, you know, seven people per lake. I'd love to have that opportunity. As Kurt Schnick, you know, and you want to talk, the big thing up there is the society. My first experience at Cass Lake, I was greeted by a local guy up there at a business when I was up there fishing. Walked up to me, said, here, I got a handful of shells in his hand, he's rolling. He goes, you got buddies coming? I go, yeah. Good, I got one of these for each of you. At our board meeting on Tuesday, I brought this up in front of our group. And the biggest thing I heard from our board members is one person was up there the day after a person was shot at the boat landing with his wife. Another person brought up the fact that he was up going up to a resort up there. He was told to head directly towards that resort. Do not stop anywhere. Get there, stay there for your own safety. That is the reason why the economy up there is hurting, because people don't want to go there. They don't feel safe. When your own business owners are telling people that are coming there visiting, that is the reason. Lifting this ban will not improve the economy up there. I mean, 14,000 anglers. How many people do you expect are going to go up there in a three-month period? If it's truly an economic issue, there's better means for supporting the economy than that. This ain't going to create tons of jobs. This ain't going to bring new business. There ain't no new income coming in. It's a small group. Back on to the next thing. As stated, 35% of lakes are stocked and managed for the fisheries. Right now, there's 2,000 lakes out there. We're managing 100 lakes that have muskie in it, fishable muskie. That's not 35%. See, these are numbers that are made up. Then they make things stay what they want to say. Get the facts. That's why we like to see this in what we asked in the Senate hearing was a table list, get this back to the DNR, let them do the work. The butternut study where they use Wisconsin. I grew up there. I know about the lake. It got over-harvested by local fishermen. It got overstocked by muskie. That study was flawed. Even the state of Wisconsin does not stand behind it now. But the Dark House keeps using it in their stance to try to prevent the future and, you know, for letting us have more lakes to fish. So you can't keep making numbers up. Yeah, I fish professionally. I travel out throughout the state. Guarantee you, right now, Minnesota is the state of choice in Wisconsin, in all the U.S. to fish. Been to Kentucky all the way to New York traveling for a few years now. Everybody that I meet on the trail, they look forward to coming to the state of Minnesota. Our DNR have done a wonderful job in creating a truly trophy fishery. There are more 50 inches fish coming out of this lake, 10-pound walleye. The state of Minnesota's DNR is a world-class job of how they manage this resource. To question their ability, to me, is just another undermining task. In today's society, everything is about going green, creating a renewable resource. Spearing does not release the fish to be there tomorrow. So I ask that we table this bill for further notice and put it back to the DNR and let them do their due diligence in resolving this issue. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Potter. I think that's Potter. Rory Potter.
The other Potter.
Oh, the other Potter. Okay.
There's our made up numbers right in the DNR.
Well, I hear you.
Yep. Mr. Chairperson, Senator Purcell. Yeah, my name is Rory Potter. I live in the Cass Lake area. I actually live on Lake Andrusia. I have a Cass Lake address. My wife and I spend a lot of our disposable income in the Cass Lake area. Teal's Grocery Store is my favorite grocery store, you know, phenomenal bakery. Mr. Mayor's got a tough job trying to create jobs and you know, tourism. I've heard countless times in the last couple of weeks that this is a social issue. I believe that. One of the things I don't like about going to Teal's Grocery Store, for an example, is having to deal with dogs in the parking lot. You know, my wife is in the transportation industry. She's gotten permission from her boss that if there's too many dogs where she's supposed to fill up her van, she's got permission to drive into Bemidji, and she's had to exercise that on a couple of occasions. Spearing, I know a lot of the spears in the area. I spent all day yesterday with the Paul Bunyan chapter of the Dark House Association, helping them out with their kids' perch derby. They would love to spear Cass Lake, but would Cass Lake benefit economically? No, because they're still going to spend all their money where they spend it now. I mean, we're talking about one lake, you know, when there's dozens of lakes within a few miles of Cass Lake. You know, they're still going to, you know, nothing's going to change economically for Cass Lake. And it's like been stated earlier, I travel quite a bit too for my job, and I talk to people all over the country that dream of coming to Cass Lake. And, you know, it's because of what the DNR has done. And to question what they've done is just, I'm just beside myself. I have a small business in Cass Lake. I know how hard it is to work, but I'm living where I used to vacation, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. But this is just not the Cliff's goals to increase economic stability. This is not the avenue they should be going. I'll end it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Knock, Kyle Knock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kyle Knock, and I'm not here representing any specific group or particular group at all. I am just an avid fisherman of muskellunge and larger northern pike, and a concerned citizen. And part of the reason for that is it's just gotten much harder to find big, quality northern pike in the state of Minnesota. It seems to me that a lot of the lakes that these pike do exist are lakes that have spearing bans in place right now. And like has already been mentioned here today, a lot of monies that come to the state of Minnesota come from all over the United States, because Minnesota clearly is recognized right now as one of the leading states in the country in terms of having a quality fishery. The DNR has done a phenomenal job, and frankly, they're the envy. We are the envy of many muskie fishermen across the United States because of the job that they've done. I just want to touch on a couple quick things. One is that, to my knowledge, the spearing community is 0.8% of the 1.2 million resident anglers in the state of Minnesota, and right now the current access available to them for spearing pike is phenomenal. There's a lot of states in the country that don't allow any spearing whatsoever for non-native, non-American Indian groups, but in the state of Minnesota there's currently northern pike populations are found in 3,351 waters throughout the state of Minnesota. And this represents 2.17 million acres, or about 95% of accessible lake acreage in the state of Minnesota is open to spearing. So again, less than 1% of the people doing this have 90% of the available waters to spear. It just seems pretty crazy to me that the legislation, you know, legislators are talking about this matter, frankly. So that was one point that I wanted to make. You know, the spearing bans that are in effect right now, they're, to my knowledge, it's 26 lakes that cannot be speared. And that number used to be bigger, but in order to educate myself, I've been calling members of the DNR this past week. And by the way, where I got a lot of these statistics were from the DNR's long-range muskellunge and northern pike plan. And it's my understanding that they met as recently as 2004. And when they did, they took 10 lakes that were previously lakes that that were protected from spearing off because they didn't see any real benefit to muskies. So it's been evaluated fairly recently. At that time, they decided to leave Cass Lake, you know, unchanged. So again, going back to the DNR and the phenomenal job that they've done, To me, it just seems like to bring it to the legislation like this is a little bit of micromanagement, and I would suggest that that the process that's already in place and the mechanisms that are already in place and the great deal of taxpayer money that's gone to you know, support some of these studies, let that come to fruition. If you think about it, in Cass Lake, what they're looking at...
All right, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Do we have questions of any of the testifiers from the committee? Anyone want to have anyone come up, you ask any questions? There being none. The DNR. Welcome, Mr. Bogus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife. I think I'm being joined by our new fisheries chief that I'd like to introduce the committee, Dirk Peterson. I'll just make a few brief introductory remarks about Cass Lake and then have Mr. Peterson distribute some information, talk a little bit about the history of the process and the biology that led to where we are now. As you've heard in the testimony, people are very passionate about their activities on this lake and other lakes in the state. This has been a very contentious issue. It was one of the more contentious muskie designations that we did. It was the Cass Lake was designated in 1988 under an experimental regulation for 10 years, and then that was evaluated using a variety of methods that Mr. Peterson will talk about, and then the regulation was made into a special regulation in 1998 that continues to this day, and we've seen improvements in the musk-lunge population in the lake during that time, and it's difficult to attribute what all may have contributed to that, but we believe that the spearing ban was one of the factors that may have contributed to that, but it really comes down to a question of, you know, what the type and structure of fisheries that the people want in the lake. So it does fall into this more social arena of how we manage this fishery, and with that, I'm going to ask Mr. Peterson to walk the committee quickly through what the DNR's process and findings have been associated with Cass Lake.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Dirk Peterson, the new fisheries chief for the DNR. And you've already heard a fair amount about the process by which the ban was initially placed. When it was evaluated in 97, there were some issues around the study design that weren't up to full standards, but we had a species that is difficult to sample and it's at low density. And so we employed a lot of avenues in collecting information about this species, from our creel surveys to our standard lake surveys, to taxidermy records, to angler diaries, to spring trap netting, to fall electrofishing. We tried to gather as much information as we could to take a look at this critter in this system under this spearing ban and make some judgment about whether the ban should be continued or not. In 97-98, public hearings were heard on the proposed rule, and it was a very contentious process at that time. And there was a slight majority of folks that were in favor of the ban, and our assessment of the available information based on the standards for the rule, which was there an enhancement to the muskie population? That was the standard by which we were held to. And based on the information that we reviewed, we felt that, and as Mr. Bogus indicated, there may have been several factors, but one of the contributing factors was the spearing ban to the improvement in the size of the muskie population. If you look at the graphics that are on the back side of the page, the first one is just showing you where Cass Lake is and where some of the connected waters are. The next one looks at our creel surveys through time. The blue bars show the average size of muskie that are caught by anglers. These are the everyday anglers as well as the focused ones that are out there at the time. And the pre-data piece is the 83 to 87. Then you see the following blue bars for additional information through 2004 through 2009. And over time, the average size caught has increased. That includes released fish. The average size of fish over 40 has increased. That's the red line with boxes. The fish over 48 are the green diamonds, and that has increased. And the number of fish over 50 inches has increased over time. So anyway, at least based on our assessment, the muskie population has been enhanced while the spearing ban has been in place. The other graphic at the bottom is another aspect of our creel information. And what you'll see with the boxes is a fourfold increase for northern pike angling that's occurred since the mid-80s. The diamonds are a twofold increase of anglers seeking muskie. The X's along the top are indicating that the average size of northern pike has remained relatively stable during this period of evaluation. So part of the analysis is, of course, are the northern pike anglers are probably releasing some of these fish as well to maintain the average size of the northern pike from our creel surveys. That just gives an overview of the information that we have and some of the information we use to evaluate the spearing ban. And I'll take any questions that you may have.
Questions from the members, Mr. Peterson, Mr. Boggess. Representative McNamara.
Welcome. Glad to have you on board. For either one of you, I'm curious, what's the fine for spearing a muskie?
Three big ones. I'm sorry, Representative McNamara, $3,000.
Rodman, is that correct?
Really? Whoa, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my next one, do you know, are the tribal members, are they allowed to spear muskies?
Representative McNamara, Mr. Chair, yes, they are. By federal tribal treaty rights, they can spear and gill net Cass Lake.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Purcell, it seems like some in the audience, does the DNR are saying that they can't spear muskies, or that's what I was wondering, if they can spear muskies.
Unless they know that that's been, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Smith, could you come down? Do you know the answer to that question?
Unless someone knows that muskies are. I'm not aware that that's not in the regs. I do know that it's open for gill netting.
Welcome again, Mayor.
I knew I'd get more than 3 minutes.
There you go. That's what being a mayor is all about.
In regards to
McNamara's
question, no, tribal members cannot spear.
Muskies.
Okay. That was an agreement reached with a tribal attorney, Mr. Bond, enlightened me that tribal members cannot spear. They can gill net. They cannot spear muskies. Okay.
Hey, Representative McNamara.
Well, no, I would like a follow-up, Mr. Chair, if I could. So, Mr. Mayor, you can spear northerns on Cass Lake?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mayor... Mr. Mayor, have you speared northerns on Cass Lake?
I've only speared once in my life.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mayor. We may give you some more time in a minute. We'll see how the questions come here. Other questions of members? Representative Cornish.
For the new chief of fisheries there, Mr. Chair and members, what would happen if you opened it up and then just kept track of it very closely? Is it your opinion that it would be, change would take place faster, or would you have time? I mean, I'm troubled with this being an old study and new methods available, and troubled with a lot of things. I think Representative Purcell knows his area, and there was only a slight majority margin before, and I'm a spearer myself, so I'm just kind of wondering about the fairness here. And the spearers having such a short window of their exercise, their opportunity, and these guys fishing on the open lake got all year long, and not all year long till the ice gets there, and they're throwing lures this long. They're not trying to attract minnows. They're after big fish, too. So I guess I take offense at some of the testimony here making these guys look like harpooners of big fish, that the only people that are after big fish are spears. But that's, I'm digressing. But back to the original question, what would happen if you just opened it up and just kept close track on it, and then if you needed to shut it down in the future or something bad happened?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, as I stated before, this is a species at low density, and it's difficult to sample. And so part of the concern when spearing bans have been placed on lakes that have muskie is the incidental, accidental, or intentional killing of large fish. And I think the standard for a trophy now is over 48 inches, and that fish is probably 20 years to produce. And so a few of those fish represent a lot of investment in that fishery if it is being managed for muskie. For us to be able to detect that specifically at that level would be difficult.
You got a follow-up on that, Representative Cornish? One of the testifiers said that there were a certain number of lakes that were only a certain number of lakes. I thought I wrote it down. I thought that they said in the 20s that were closed to spearing, which would say that many more are open. How many lakes are closed to spearing in the state, spearing of northern pike?
Mr. Chairman, there are 26 lakes. I think Cass is probably the largest.
Okay. Other questions by the committee? Okay, there being none, Representative Purcell, the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe I could probably try and clarify some of the things that have been said, but I think I'm not going to. There's been some statements that may be taken out of context, and I could talk science for a long time, I think, but I'll spare the committee. Just let me follow up and close that the community and the resorters on Cass Lake, in and around Cass Lake. I've heard one individual here today from that area that said that they wasn't supportive of lifting this ban, but the resorts that around Cass Lake, the entire community, and there's signed sealed petitions on this stuff are in support of lifting this ban. Certainly would be it would provide some economic incentives for the area, and that's something that's sorely needed. I have numbers here. 100% of the businesses contacted in Cass Lake signed a letter in support of lifting the ban. And I heard some testimony here. I think I may need to call my wife and make sure it's safe to go home. I don't know what that's all about, but I live there. I've lived there 30 years. I don't know what's up with that, but so I just want to say that I appreciate your support on this bill, and would try and answer any other questions that anybody has.
All right, to Representative McNamara.
Well, just to that point, Mr. Chair, I wasn't going to say anything, but Representative Purcell, thank you for mentioning what you just did, and I would hope. We have an extremely troubling letter from, I believe, one of your constituents or potentially one of Representative Saylor's constituents. I hope that you will follow up with some of these folks, because there's some really troubling comments made in this letter from people of authority that is really scary. And I'll just leave it at that. But I hope, whether they're part of the majority or the minority, they certainly have a right to their opinion and shouldn't have what's written in some of this letter, Mr. Chair.
Okay, with that, Representative Purcell renews his motion to lay over for possible conclusion 3227. Thank you, Representative Purcell.
Thank you,
House file 3351, Representative Tao.
Yes, sir. Okay, Mr. Chair, I move 3551 for possible inclusion in the game and fish bill. Essentially, the bill, what it right now, we allow scope only for folks with, I believe, with some visual impairment. And the bill takes that away and allow anybody to use a scope on a muzzle loader up to four times magnification. That's it.
All right. Questions for the committee? Representative Cornish.
Representative Tout, you know how I feel about the bill, and I've expressed it many times. I'm just kind of wondering why, I guess if you formed it in a question rather than just go off on comments, is why somebody wouldn't have to do this, because you can use a scope on a muzzleloader now during regular firearm season and have ample opportunity. And when we started it out, it was for the primitive hunt. And a lot of us would just like to see it stay like that, since you can use a scope, you know, in regular firearm season up north and down south. And we just like to save it for the more traditional style of hunting. And right now, the visually impaired can be taken care of with a scope. So I'm just kind of confused why we would have to turn this into just basically an extended hunt, because now the inlines, as you know, they shoot regular symmetrical copper jacketed bullets. We put scope on there. It's kind of like high power rifle season up north, and we're worried about this long season being changed if we get too successful and pooping them out there at long ranges and taking more deer. Just that's my concerns. I was wondering where this comes from, why there is a need to have the muzzleloader of scopes.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, I don't think we could put a stop to technology, I guess. If we want to go back to just basic muzzle loader, I guess we could just say, let's just do a flintlock and with nothing on it. But my philosophy is, you go out there to hunt, probably better to be able to see the deer well and shoot right in the target, right exactly where you want to shoot. So,
well, Representative Cornish, are you ready to move to amend for flintlock?
Yeah, actually, Mr. Chair, in a number of states they do have a primitive. It's side hammers only and cap locks and flint locks and no scopes, and then they have the regular more modern firearm season. And so I'm wondering if you're in the future interested in any compromise where we could split the season for traditional and modern, or some way of modifying this. I would have been nice to have a meeting with the DNR and talk with them, before session, and talk about a primitive firearm season, so that, it's a 16-day season where you could split it in half. And I know the inline people and the modern firearm people are going to really squawk at that, but it seems like fair is fair if we organize the whole system for the primitive firearms, and now we want to change it over to basically high powers with scopes almost. So are you open to anything like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, if he passes tonight, I'm open to anything in the future.
Another Representative McBride.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I feel the same way Representative Cornish does. We've been holding this off for a long time. If we're going to allow scopes on muzzle loaders, which is essentially a rifle, once you put a scope on it, I think we might as well just do away with the season, or just make it for flintlocks only. Make the season like Representative Cornish is recommending. Not have a season at all for muzzle loaders, the new modern muzzle loaders with scopes. We already allow it during the regular firearm season. They can already use them then. We're just extending the rifle season is all we're doing. If that's what we're going to do, is allow scopes on muzzle loaders. And I don't know why we would do it. It was originally intended to be more of a primitive hunt. That's why we set it up in the first place. We have deer management now where we allow extra deer to be taken. I think that's a weak argument that if we need to kill more deer, we already do that, and we can manage that. But we're essentially just allowing, extending the rifle season if we're going to allow this to happen. Something's got to change, and this is not the right way to go. So either we're going to allow a primitive hunt with muzzle loaders and continue to let them be included with the more primitive season with the flintlocks, or we're going to. I just don't see why we would do this. I just don't understand it. I don't comprehend it. Why do we have a special season if we're going to allow this to happen? I don't understand it.
Hey, Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a comment or maybe a question, but by placing a scope or some type of optical device on a muzzle loader, does it affect how far the projectile travels? I think the point is that by being able to see more accurately where that projectile is going, maybe that could be a safety thing that was worthwhile to discuss. To either Mr. Kelleher or to Representative Tao, maybe a rhetorical question, but what's the purpose of a muzzleloader season?
Well, we'll welcome Mr. Kelleher from the Deer Hunters Association to the podium. Mr. Kelleher, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Tom Kelleher from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. I apologize, I just walked back into the room, so I only caught a little bit of the debate. I'm going to try to answer Representative Falk's question in a little roundabout way, I think, Mr. Chairman. We'll see if I get to your question. I think traditionally, Representative Hackbarth is somewhat correct in regards to the initial creation of the muzzleloader season. However, I think in the last 10 to 15 years, and this is the end of the hunt, this is, you know, late November, December, there are comparatively speaking, there's a lot fewer hunters that time of year than during the regular firearm season. Some muzzleloader hunters are very traditionalists, flintlocks, coonskins, caps, so on and so forth. Others have a more modern technology inline muzzleloader, which is a very fine rifle. I mean, there's not a lot of inaccurate shooting up to a certain range. And I'm not completely qualified to do that, but I think Representative Fox is right that it's out about a couple hundred yards. Our association, for the last 6 years or so, have been pushing for scopes on muzzleloaders. My corporate board is, as you know, Representative Dill and others, that it's about, we have 67 chapters. We have a corporate board meeting every year. About 150 people that show up. This has always been on the agenda for like the last 6 or 8 years. It is becoming more and more on the agenda. More and more of them feel that it would be a desire to have scopes on muzzleloaders, given the fact that they are muzzleloaders today do not represent the muzzleloaders of the past. I mean, it is almost an extension of the rifle season, as Representative Hackbarth said. At this point, I don't know that certainly the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association or that there are others in the room are saying that this will, cause a proliferation of hunters at that time of year, which I know is a concern for some people in the muzzleloader communities. Like bow hunters, they like that part of the season to not be as crowded in the field. And it's sort of a don't hunt during the time I hunt argument, I think, is part of it. I don't think there's going to be a huge encouragement of people going out to muzzleload hunt during that season just because they can use scopes. And Representative Ty's bill, if you notice all the deletion of the language, you could get a muzzleloader from a variety of rationales, and I think in one of the bills floating around the state capitol, they're going to add the types of providers that can give a quote-unquote disabled permit to muzzleloader hunt with a scope. That's the long version, Representative Falk. I apologize.
Question, Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the answer I was looking for, the purpose of why there's a season, is to go out and shoot deer. And it just seems to me that this makes that a more likely outcome. So, I mean, I don't really see the issues, and I think that Representative Tao has done a nice job putting this together.
Well, Mr. Chair, in this time of hunters decline, I think this would be a good way of, getting more folks into the game as well. So,
okay, we got a question or a comment from Representative Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Falk. If you understand what the muzzleloader season was originally created for, much like bow hunting season. I don't know if you're a hunter or not, but if you're a bow hunter, you go out in the woods, you do your scouting, you find out where the deer are moving, you find a tree that's going to be where you want to hunt so you can get a close shot at a deer that's going to be coming close by, because a bow and arrow, it doesn't travel that far. So you want to get the deer as close as possible so you can get a good, clean kill. Muzzleloader season and the old flintlock season was much the same way. You want to go out and know where you're hunting, scout your area. It's a later season. It's a little bit different. There's usually a lot of snow on the ground. It's a different atmosphere. And what we're essentially doing by putting scopes on muzzleloaders, not the old flintlocks like the people were that came here to get this season put in place originally, they included the muzzleloaders along with the flintlocks. They were being nice. You know, let's include both because we've got people that do both. And at that time, the modern technology for muzzleloaders wasn't here. And to get back to the original question that you asked about, does it make it go any farther? Well, in a way it does, because when you use open sights, you're accurate so far. When you put a scope on, you're accurate a much, much further distance. So in essence, you could say, yes, they go farther, more accurately with a scope. With the modern technology you have now, you have a single-shot rifle. Essentially the same thing as my semi-automatic 30-06. I never shoot more than once anyway when I shoot a deer. I'm not going to go, you know, you hear these deer and boom, 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 they're unloading their rifle. I never do that. You take one shot and your deer is down and it's dead, and you get a good clean kill because you know your proficiency, the proficiency of the weapon, etc. All we're doing by passing this law is extending the rifle season. That's all we're doing for people that own these muzzle loaders with scopes. You can hunt right now. How much time do we have to hunt? We have all kinds of time that you can go out and hunt with your muzzle loader if that's the kind of weapon you prefer, and you can have a scope on it, and it's perfectly legal, and you don't need any special permission. You can hunt with that now. All this is extending it into a season that was originally created for a different type of hunt, which did not include modern technology that we have today. That's why I'm against this bill.
One of the things that occurred to me while you were speaking, Representative McBarth, is we crossed a similar bridge, with the Tau bill for crossbow hunting. And one of the things that when we allowed for crossbows, we actually made them during the rifle season and not during the archery season. And the reason was, is exactly what that argument was, what you just stated. Representative Hagbarth.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Tell and I worked on that, and he listened to me to get it in that shape so we could have it that way.
So you have proven that Representative Tell can listen.
For 1 year.
That is now on the record. Okay, Mr. Kelleher.
Just one last comment or two comments, Mr. Chair. I think, you know, current law is that if you would bother to go out and get a disabled permit from your physician, I think is what current law basically says, that you can have one of these. And there's also not a requirement that you must hunt with a scope on a muzzleloader. So this is just something that's available, as Representative Fogg was sort of talking about. Is the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association has been very forthcoming in promotion of increased hunting, youth hunting, and to keep people more afield hunting. And I think if this encourages some people to go out and hunt more, I don't have the fear that has been discussed about shooting beyond the range of a muzzleloader because you have a more powerful scope. And I should say that Mr. Meyer from the DNR and I were discussing that his suggestion was to remove the four power requirement because of the difficulty of judging from a distance what kind of scope is on your muzzleloader. So I think the enforcement people would like to just have it clean, not to have a power restriction, because they feel they'd have to go check everybody's power restrictions to see what type of scope they had on their muzzleloader.
Ms. Keller, could you tell us what the status of this bill is in the Senate?
The Game and Fish Bill in the Senate is a committee report that I have not seen yet. It was reported to the Senate floor today. I don't think this provision is in that committee report, but I can't say for certain.
Okay. Anyone have any further questions for the for Mr. Kelleher? Anyone in the audience like to testify for or against the? You're welcome. For or against the bill? Mr. Bogus is coming down to grace us again. The question is, Representative Hagbarth, will he listen?
He's shown that he could in the past.
Okay, he's shown that he could.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't want to speak for or against. I just wanted to provide a little bit of perspective from the department, if that's okay with you and the committee.
So we'll see if we can listen.
Again, for the record, Ed Bogus with the Department of Natural Resources. And, you know, we can manage the deer harvest with whatever type of muzzleloader season that we have, but just want the committee to be aware that we've had to get more and more restrictive with the muzzleloader season that we've been offering. It started in the late 70s as a season similar to today, but only in a few small areas of the state. There was concern at that time about not having long deer seasons with guns statewide, so it was restricted to a few areas of public land, later expanded to some larger areas of predominantly public land, and then eventually became a statewide season. But in those years, we had 5,000 to 10,000 muzzleloader hunters in the state. Now we're, I had the numbers, but I don't have them with me, but we're in the range of 65,000 muzzleloader hunters now. And the harvest has become so significant that for the first time this past fall, the 2009 deer hunting season, we had to require all muzzleloader hunters in lottery areas, which are the areas where we restrict the harvest of antlerless deer, to only those who have a permit to take an antlerless deer. And we had to make muzzleloader hunters go through a drawing for those lottery area antlerless permits. And prior to 2009, they had always been able to take a deer of either sex simply by purchasing a license over the counter. So this provision in and of itself, you know, may not have a major impact on the harvest, but we've just been seeing with the modern inline technology and the accuracy and probably most importantly with the fact that people now can hunt both the regular firearms and the muzzleloader season, which prior to the all-season license in the early 2000s, they had to pick between the two. And now we've done away with all-season and just let people buy licenses a la carte. We've really seen a dramatic growth in this. And then just lastly, you know, to address the point Mr. Kelleher just made, if the legislature, you know, pursues something like Representative Tao's bill with the four-power scope, our enforcement people with the variable power scopes that are out there would have difficulty, I think, determining what they had the scope cranked to at the time if it was a variable power scope. So that's an issue if this moves forward.
Representative McNamara.
Well, to that point, Mr. Bogus, you raised up a good question. I have a muzzle loader, and I don't have a scope on it, but I would think if we had scopes in the muzzleloader season and I was going to hunt in the shotgun season, which I did some this past year, and I used my shotgun and missed the deer, my guess is at 50 yards, if I'd had my muzzleloader on with a scope, I'd had a lot better chance. What have you analyzed that situation? I would think that a lot of shotgunners that are shooting with their bird gun potentially would outfit their muzzleloader with a scope, and what would that do? I would think that would make quite a different program all of a sudden, that we would have basically rifle hunters throughout the state, because I think the accuracy gets out maybe close to 200 yards at that point, 150 yards or whatever. Definitely different than your bird gun.
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, right now if a person wants to, and a number of people do, they can use a muzzleloader in the shotgun zone in the rifle season, I mean in the regular firearm season, with a scope on it. So they have that option now. They just can't, if they also want to hunt the muzzleloader season, they would have to remove that scope for the muzzleloader season.
And just, that was my point, Mr. Bog, is I don't think the practicality, people are going to want to take it on and off. The reality, you know how that is, you got to recite it in, there's a lot involved, where I think you would see a definite increase in the number of muzzle loaders with scopes used in the shotgun season, because then they could use it in the next season again, and there may be an impact there.
Any other questions for Mr. Bogus? Anyone to testify for or against the bill? Being none, the chair will, or Representative Talon removes his motion to lay over House File 3351 for possible inclusion in the bill, a game and fish bill. The chair moves Bill 3225 for possible inclusion. And members, the bill has to do with bear drawing licenses. It's very quite short. Line 1.14 says a person selected through a drawing must purchase this license by August 1st. Any remaining available licenses not purchased shall be issued to an eligible person as prescribed by the commissioner on a first-come, first-served basis beginning August 2nd. Okay, we've been consulting with the department. We are going to probably be, at the very least, adding a day or two in between August 1st and August 2nd, one way or the other, because they need just a little more time to check their list and make sure they haven't made a mistake of someone that was drawn, and they want to confirm those things. They just need a little more leeway, elbow room, only a day or two, maybe three. We'll work that out, and we'll have that number in the next committee. And this will take care of a problem that was created last year, that during the bear season, the phone rang off the hook over. So with that, we'll lay that bill over for possible inclusion. The chair renews his motion on 3325 to lay it over for possible inclusion. All right. Then we have some amendments to be... Did anyone want to testify for or against that bill? You want to?
We're okay.
You're good. Okay. And you heard what I said about that leeway that we're working on? Okay. Mr. Meyer says yes. Okay, so now the chair will move House File 3124, and we'll go to the bill itself. And if Mr. Bogus could come forward again and just quickly run through the bill very quickly, and then we'll have members ask questions of the bill. Many things in here, member, are technical. Some are not. So, Mr. Bogus, welcome. Again, House File 3124, the chair has moved the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Quickly, the first, and I think members have a fact sheet that was drafted to an earlier version of this as proposed by the department that has some background information, but I'm going to work off of the bill because the section numbers have changed. So, sections 1 through 4 deal with fish testing and are related to some viral hemorrhagic septicemia legislation that we passed a couple years ago to deal with that VHS fish disease that's spreading through the Great Lakes states. And we've identified that there's a bottleneck in that process with fish collectors or people who are certified to oversee the chain of collection of, or chain of evidence, basically, of the collection of fish samples for testing by certified laboratories. So you'll see some definitions, some procedures according to some of the fish health standards. And in section 3, training and certification requirement for fish collectors, so that in addition to some of the lab people that DNR has or that the university has, we can certify others to help aquaculture interests collect fish for sampling, and the lack of fish collectors won't be the bottleneck that it is now. Section 4 is related to the clarification or some technical changes in the guidelines for the fish health testing. And I think that's all I'll say about those for now. Section 5 relates to sucker eggs, and these are provisions for aquaculture, commercial aquaculture people to obtain sucker eggs as authorized by the commissioner. Right now, that's tied to the acres of waters of the state that they have licensed for aquaculture. So the more acres they have licensed, the more sucker eggs they're eligible to obtain. We'd like to decouple that allocation of sucker eggs from the acreage of waters and just be able to allocate based on their historical use, the new requests, the condition of sucker spawning runs on the historical streams, and get away from tying it to the acreage of water. Section 6 relates to some, Section 6 and 7 relate to some planning. We just want to eliminate some obsolete fish and wildlife planning requirements. There's also a section in the repealer that deals with this so that we can have flexibility. Right now we're doing more department type strategic planning with long range and operational plans as needed for specific species or issues. Section 8 deals with bait harvest from infected waters. Right now for commercial netting in infested waters that are designated because they have invasive fish, invertebrates, or certifiable diseases, they can't use their nets or traps in other waters, but that did not cover minnow trapping in those infested waters, so this would just add minnow trapping with the same requirement that's already in place for commercial. Section 9 are some definitions of accompanied that relate to the apprentice hunter validation that's later in the bill, plus we're trying to define the term accompanied is used with youth hunters at certain ages, and we're trying to define for the different types of hunting what's meant by that term. So you'll see definitions for hunting small game other than wild turkey, for hunting wild turkey or big game, and then for accompanied if you're using an apprentice validation, which is what allows you to hunt when you'd normally be required to have a firearm safety if you're accompanied. Section 10 is a technical type amendment related to Eurasian collared doves, which are a species of non-native doves, very similar in appearance to mourning doves, that are native to Europe and Asia and have been spreading from the southeastern United States north and westward and occur in southern Minnesota right now. Section 11 relates to lakes that are designated for wildlife management purposes. There are about 40 of these in the state that go through a public process of designation that allows them to be managed for wildlife purposes primarily. And current law does not allow restriction of fishing in those lakes. This would create an exception for restricting the taking of minnows so that we could regulate that during key times of disturbance or as necessary to accomplish the primary wildlife management function. Section 12 deals with refunds and makes a technical change that the refund can be issued if the request is received within 90 days, and then adds another criteria for issuing a refund if the licensee was not legally required to purchase the license. So the most common example, that's a military person on leave or veteran who doesn't need a license accidentally buys one. Section 13 relates to technical change on failure to appear so that it just covers the circumstances that might result in a person failing to appear in court. Section 14 would create a separate selection for elk license drawings that would allow, and this is identical to what's in law for moose licenses right now, that 20% of the licenses would be issued, up to 20%, to individuals who've applied at least 10 times unsuccessfully. Section 15 would provide Commissioner broader authority to do rules on setting turkey seasons and methods for issuing licenses so that we could do over-the-counter licenses and not have to set the number of licenses in advance. Section 16 is a technical clarification language passed last year on fishing in state parks without a an angling license that would clarify that it also applies to ice fishing. Section 17 would just clarify that doves may be transported in accordance with federal law. They're a federally classified migratory game bird and do not, currently they have to comply with state law. Federal law is more liberal for transportation. Section 18 for the apprentice hunter validation would change the age to 13 or over, make it something that could be exercised twice in a person's lifetime instead of once, and allow it for bear in addition to small game and deer hunting. Section 19, and there are several sections here that relate to provisions for issuing disability type permits for scopes on muzzleloaders, hunting from a vehicle by a disabled hunter, and using a crossbow. That in all of these sections, it would just allow, in addition to a licensed physician, it would allow a certified nurse practitioner or certified physician assistant acting under the direction of a licensed physician, because that just reflects the reality of the medical profession today, where they don't always see the licensed physician for these types of certifications. Section 21 is a technical change that would add doves to the exemption for on the opening day of the duck season, when the shooting hours for migratory game birds begin. Right now, under current law, dove hunting could not start before 9 a.m. on the opening day of the duck season. Section 22, I already talked about, that's a physician assistant or nurse practitioner issue again for crossbows. Section 23 would give the commissioner authority to issue licenses to hunters to take elk that are causing damage or nuisance, rather than a shooting permit to a landowner or a sharpshooter or something like that. And it would exempt a person who got a license in that situation from losing their lifetime eligibility, once-in-a-lifetime eligibility, to participate in a more true type of elk hunt. Section 24 would repeal the restriction, the state restriction on the duck season not being allowed to open before the Saturday nearest October 1st, and would allow the commissioner to prescribe seasons in accordance with federal law. The current federal framework is 7 days earlier than that, and this would provide some flexibility to possibly open earlier in parts of the state or zone, or split the state and open earlier to earlier in parts of the state or zone, or split the state and open earlier to try to take advantage of some early migrants that are sometimes out of the state. Section 25 would provide some pretty narrow authority for the commissioner to be exempt from rulemaking to make mid-season adjustments, and this is basically dealing with Mille Lacs Lake. It's for fisheries in the 1837 ceded territory, and we're required to make mid-season adjustments if necessary to stay within the state's allocation. And under the current rulemaking, we sometimes would have chosen a different regulation to stay within the allocation if we'd had more time to do it. This would allow us that that flexibility to quickly decide what sort of mid-season adjustment would need to be made. Section 26 is a technical clarification that fish management tags, and right now that sturgeon tags, that a person can make, cannot make more than one application per calendar year. When the fishing license year was extended to 14 months through from March 1 through April 30th, it creates an overlap with a person potentially being able to get two tags for one sturgeon season. So we just want to clarify that we mean calendar year rather than license year. Section 27 would give the commissioner authority, if emergency fish disease is documented in Minnesota waters, to prohibit the transportation of live fish that's allowed under this paragraph. And this paragraph allows a person age 16 or under for aquarium purposes to transport bass, perch, crappie, etc., taken by angling, and puts some limits on how many. And this is really the last exception to not allowing the transport of live fish in the state. Section 28 would give the commissioner authority to authorize use of game fish eggs as bait. This is a common technique for steelhead anglers on the North Shore, and we'd like some some authority to authorize. Right now, you can't use parts of game fish for bait, but this would give some authority to work out some rules to allow that practice. And paragraph B would just clarify that import of certain types of bait from VHS positive waters would not be allowed for any type of bait used for taking wild animals. Angling does not. We discovered that this didn't include things like minnow trapping or turtle trapping or even some other types of trapping. So this would just basically prohibit VHS positive water baits of aquatic worms, amphibians, invertebrates, and insects from any of those VHS waters. And then the repealers, I think we've talked about most of these. There's some on the planning, the turkey license eligibilities to give us more flexibility there, and then the apprentice hunter definition of a company. It's being replaced by the definition I discussed earlier.
Okay, thank you very much. Before we go to questions, they're going to offer an amendment. The chair's amendment is on page 6. Beginning on line 6.4, section 9, ending on 6.17 at the period, deleting that section, and also the repealer on page 13, line 13.34, and 97B.022, comma. Those two deletions from the bill will get rid of the accompanied part and leave in statute the existing definition. You want to say that again, though? Where at? Oh, the subdivision one as well? Okay. So I'm going to restate that on the repealer section. I'll restate that if I can find it. Okay, the repealer on line 13.34, we'd repeal and 97B.022, comma, subdivision 1. So section 9 and then that line item on 13.34. Discussion on the amendment. Being none in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevailed. All right, questions for Mr. Bogus on the bill as amended, 3124. And we are going to have more amendments momentarily. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I see the handout we have has got different section numbers, and I'm assuming these are some things that were not to your liking or the department has changed, but there's a few provisions. I'm just wondering if you or the department can speak. The handout before us has some different section numbers, and I'm wondering if you or...
Let her rip.
If I start, it mentions Section 12 acquisition procedure. I don't know, Mr. Bogus, you probably know these. Are these agency initiatives that the committee didn't want to bring forward, or what are they? It looks like there's about five or six of them.
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, these provisions that are in the fact sheet that are not in the bill are provisions that the department had drafted initially as our game and fish bill.
And Mr. Representative McNamara, I reviewed the bill. They gave me the bill to introduce the bill. I got rid of the things that I didn't want in the bill and then had the bill redrafted and submitted the bill as introduced.
Well, if I can ask, Mr. Chair, do you want to whip through? I'm just curious what they are, or do you want Mr. Bogus? If you don't mind, I wouldn't mind hearing just what they are quickly.
One of them is the deer baiting, extending the deer baiting. I remember that. But go ahead, Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, committee members, I can make this quick. The sections that were removed from the bill, one of them would have... on acquisition procedure on the fact sheet, it's listed as Section 12 and would have provided an alternative appeal process if a county board denied an acquisition of a wildlife management area to go to directly to the Land Exchange Board without having to first go to district court. The deer baiting and feeding, sections 14 through 21 and 32, it's called on this fact sheet would have established a number of additional penalties related to violation of deer baiting or feeding regulations. Current fines and penalties have not been a deterrent to an increase in baiting activity, so we had proposed some other types of penalties that we had hoped would be more of a deterrent. And then there was a proposed restriction on wildlife feeding from the 1st of September through the end of December. Deer seasons open in mid-September and go through December. You know, for people that feel the need to feed deer, we don't encourage the feeding of deer, but they don't need feeding prior to you know, the end of the year. Certainly, even in severe winters, they're not in any sort of distress, nutritional distress at that time of the year. What's labeled here, Section 15, penalty for hunting big game when the license is revoked, would have made it a gross misdemeanor to take big game during a time that a person's prohibited from obtaining a license to take big game. Then what's labeled Section 33 on big game stand restrictions would have just proposed to create a consistent stand height. The current law has a permanent stand height of no more than 16 feet for deer, 9 feet for moose, 9 feet for elk, and no limit for bear. And there's a provision before the committee that would just repeal this stand height entirely. The bear hunter drawing, Section 34, we would have eliminated the second choice bear permit application. When we went to the second choice last year, the people who took the second choice ended up basically accounting for all the licenses that used to be surplus that some of the outfitters had counted on. And we've been working with the chair on an alternative to try to address that problem. And then Section 36, shooting grouse near motor vehicles. This was a rule that the department put into place back in the mid-90s that prohibited shooting a grouse near a motor vehicle unless the person was at least 20 yards from the vehicle and the engine was shut off. And that was repealed by the legislature, I think, 2 years ago. So those are the provisions that are in this fact sheet that aren't in the bill.
Representative Magnemeyer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think you've eliminated some things that I wouldn't have liked either. The one I would say, I hope, and I don't know if it had happened before 4:30 tomorrow, but this deer baiting issue is huge. And it's not working what we have now. We got people that are cheating big time, and I think we need to look at that and get it so people start abiding by the rules. So I'm not sure. That's the number one. The grouse hunting's not my deal, Mr. Chair. That's your deal. We don't have grouse to speak of anymore. But that's all I have on that. But I did have an oral amendment.
Before you do the oral amendment, I think that the bill was introduced, I think, maybe Mr. Bogus could tell us this, that the bill was introduced as it was presented to me in the Senate without any amendment or removal of provisions. Is that right or wrong, Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair, they actually drafted the bill to correspond with the House file, but then did a delete all amendment that essentially put it back into the form that the department had first requested and then worked on it from there.
So go ahead with your oral amendment.
Well, before the oral amendment, I did have one that I'm working with the department on, and I'm wondering if we could have the latitude. I'm not ready. I don't think we can do it orally, but it's just the addition, I believe, we need of one word. In the turkey landowner permit, there's a big discussion. The word family is in there, and I believe we should have the word immediate. So I'd like to draft an amendment that have it ready at Chair Eakin's committee tomorrow. It's not on here, and rather than go to this, unless Ms. Taylor thinks I could go, it's not in. I'd have to draft it. I'd rather, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, we can bring it up here. But it says family, and immediate family is identified in the dictionary and stuff, and we'd know what it is. I've got 100 first cousins. That's not second cousins. I mean, if I move out at the nursery, I could have 1,000 people having landowner permits, and I don't know if that was ever the intention. So that's just an informational and hopeful that I can bring it forward in Eakin's committee tomorrow and he'll allow it.
Sounds reasonable to me if that's how you'd like to proceed.
And then, Mr. Chair, I do have an oral amendment. I think you must have overlooked. There was one other that change you should have made from the DNR's recommendations. And it would be probably the most common sense one that you somehow inadvertently overlooked it. If we could go to page 11, I'll be real quick, Representative Ackbart. Page 11, line 29, down at the bottom, section 24, I'd like to move an oral amendment to reinstate the stricken language on line 1129 and 1131. Members, we do not want to be shooting mallards in September when you can't tell if it's a hen or a drake. We should not be opening the season. This will open the duck season on September 25. It's absolutely the wrong thing to be doing. We should.
Can we just delete the section? Make your amendment to delete section 24.
Would that work? I was just deleting the. Okay.
Yeah, just delete the section.
I'll move to delete section 24.
Don't worry, Meyer will have it put in on the other side. So.
I lost that. What was that?
Don't worry, they'll do a delete all on the other side and get it back in.
That's my last one, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that amendment.
Any discussion on deletion of Representative McNamara's motion, delete section 24? There being none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevail. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Bogus? Okay. Being none, thank you very much. You might want to stay because I'm sure you're going to have more comments on some of these. No doubt in my mind. So now we've got amendments. The first amendment would be to add in the, these are the land bills, right?
These are bills previously heard by the
committee. Oh, yeah, okay. These are bills previously heard by the committee and were included either in the bill last year, last year's game and fish bill that left the House floor, or any of them heard this year, yeah, or heard this year and laid over. So the chair will move to amend. Oh, the A. Oh, we have an amendment to do all this. The A5 amendment, the 3124 A5. And so we've got the first part of it is the deer killed by motor vehicles. That's section 17. And that's the Kitson County. That's what started the ball rolling on this. Then the Representative Cornish's deer stand height restrictions. We're still on a roll to eliminate a tape measure as standard issuance to conservation officers. And then the Representative Tao's provision, section 25, to allow the use of a drum on private land, chained and also labeled for dispensing food. It can't have an automatic bait dispenser, or as Representative Bigham would say, a bear buffet. The next item is Representative Junkie's section 30, which is two lines with a $10 fee. Section 33 is Representative Coonan's coyote conflict management option for counties. Then the effective date and the repealer. And so we need to take out of the repealer on line 2.21 the same repealer that we took out earlier in the first amendment to this bill regarding the word, the definition of accompanied. And so on line 2.21, we'd have 97B.022, comma, subdivision 1, semicolon. That would be deleted from the A5 amendment. Discussion on the amendment. Okay. So the chair will, do we need to vote? We just incorporate it. Okay, we'll incorporate that oral amendment on line 2.21. Any further discussion on the A5 as amended? Being none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevailed. Okay. The next item is the amendment. 3124A2. And this is regarding the incidental taking of muskrat or otter in a beaver trap during the beaver season. I can tell you, members, that neither the DNR nor the Minnesota Trappers Association likes this amendment, so we might have the right language. So far, they are like two dogs under the control of Michael Vick when it comes to this issue. And this is a long-standing goings-on here. So this would allow for a person that incidentally took an otter or a muskrat in a beaver set to put their name, their license number, date, and time of the place where it was taken, and then to notify a conservation officer no later than 24 hours after the taking, and then that the pelt shall be given to the Minnesota Trappers Association, and the sale of those pelts must be used to support the association's education efforts, because they totally, under, as I understand it, they totally fund the trapper education from their proceeds. And so I want to adopt the amendment, and then we have we'll put them back in the ring and see where we can get to before we get this completed. Right now, a person can tend his trap, but it's suggested that they hang the pelt in a tree, go and get in their vehicle or on their four-wheeler or snowmobile, go to the nearest place that they can contact a conservation officer, call him, ask him to go out to the field where the sighting is, where the tending was, inspect the fur, and then the trapper gives that fur to the, or some, I guess they pelt the fur and receive a pelting fee, and then where the fur goes from there, I have no idea, except that it's a possession of the department. And I'm just trying to get them to move in a different direction. Seems to me that there's probably a fair number of animals that don't get properly handled under those scenarios, that people don't contact the CO, they leave them in the woods, dispose of them. As I said, no one's in agreement on this. At least, no one's in agreement with me, which is a good thing. Because that means that they're still talking. So, Representative Hansen?
Mr. Chair, and maybe I can try to help you here, but on lines 1.7, 1.8, I think it might be better language to have it, the pelt of the animal given to a person authorized by the Trappers Association, rather than the association. The association as an entity might be hard to give it to, but that's just a suggestion.
Well, that's a good suggestion, and I'm not ready to amend this at this time, but that's a good suggestion. And I think that between now and tomorrow, hopefully the steam will pop on this issue, and we'll have something for Representative Eakin's committee. Further discussion on this amendment? Being none, in favor of the amendment, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. What do we got next here? The A6. The A6 amendment also has to do with trapping. Chair will move the A6 amendment. And this changes the opening of muskrat, beaver, otter, and mink trapping season to the third Saturday in October in the forest zone only. Again, there's no peace in the valley on this amendment at the moment, but it's forcing the issue forward. The people in the north like this amendment. The Trappers Association doesn't like the amendment. The DNR, I don't know that they like anything that we do, but nonetheless, we will. Any questions on the amendment? Being none, in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right, and then we've got a DNR amendment. We've got the Florida Lake Amendment, A7 amendment. A lake associate, the chair will move the A7 amendment. Florida Lake is out by Wilmer. and I believe it's in Renville County. And it is a lake where the Community Lake Association has worked to establish substantial population of crappie, and it's still growing. And their president of the Lake Association has asked that around a certain area, the outlet of the lake, that area be closed during that time of year when the water starts to warm up, which is just before the walleye season, and that opens up water, starts to run water there, and the crappie apparently are quite vulnerable at that time, and people are fishing very hard at that location. And it doesn't have to do with the spawning, because the fish don't spawn then, but we do, under other conditions, close spawning areas to fishing pressure. And so I see Mr. Peterson came to the table, so we'll let him give his 2 cents worth on the Lake Florida fishing restrictions. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to reflect a little bit on this situation where we're familiar with spring crappie fishing. We tend to have concentrations. We see probably our most famous crappie fishing contest occur in the spring on Lake Minnetonka. And whether it be on a rock pile in the middle of the lake or at the outlet of this lake, crappie concentrations and concentrated harvest of fish at that time is commonplace throughout the state. And they have movements that come in early for warm water feeding. They move out. They may spawn somewhere else. In Florida Lake, which is about 800 acres, our field staff would say that crappie spawning is not limited, and therefore harvest at this site is certainly acceptable within the context of maintaining a quality crappie fishing experience on that lake. And as far as posting a spawning area, we over the years we've tried to limit the number of spawning areas that we post from a previous high to a relatively low number we do now. And where most of those spawning protection closures are most effective is in, like, in the northeastern part of the state, where you may just have a small gravelly spit on a fairly deep infertile lake where it may be suitable for sunfish, crappie, or even largemouth bass to hold on in a lake like that. Lake like Florida Lake will provide ample spawning area for all those panfish and bass-related species, and therefore I believe the closure at this site for spawning purposes would probably be relatively ineffective for enhancing the population.
Questions of Mr. Peterson? Okay, I got a couple of questions. Well, first off, make sure the committee knows that this, I just cited the spawning as one of the ways that they do close down an area. This isn't a spawning area, so we're clear on that. And have you had lake associations come to you and ask for closings of this nature when they weren't related to a spawning? I know our Crane Lake Commercial Club, where I live, came and asked for you to post the Crane Lake Gorge, and you did.
Yeah.
And that absolutely makes sense. I mean, that's just like shooting fish in a barrel there in the right time of the year. The question, though, is a different question. Is if other lake associations came to you and said, we put our skin in the game by getting the crappie established in this lake, and we'd like to protect it under certain circumstances. Have other lake associations done that?
I can't speak for every situation around the lake, but generally we decline in that situation. It's meant to protect the fish. In the case of the Florida Lake Association, we have granted permits to allow them to stock some fish, but it's not because spawning areas or the population itself is limited.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Peterson or Mr. Bogus on this amendment? Anyone to testify for or against the amendment? Okay, there being none. Chair renews his motion on the A7 amendment. In favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. All right, now we have a DNR amendment to the A10-2259. Mr. Bogus, can you explain this, or do you want me to explain it?
I'm trying to find it, Mr. Chairman.
It has to do with the recovery of the cost on a pictorial turkey stamp.
I found it, Mr. Chairman. I can explain it quickly. Current law, a pictorial stamp is no longer required as a licensing document to hunt for any species or fish for trout or salmon, but a person can still get the pictorial stamp if they'd like to by paying an extra $2 fee, and we have a self-mailer that we send out the stamp in. It's become an issue with some of the budget oversight committees in the Game and Fish Fund that the $2 is more than covering our costs, so we'd like the current cost, according to our calculations, averages across all the types of stamps about 62 cents per stamp to produce the stamp and mail it out. So we'd like the authority to, by written order in the state register, establish fees that neither recover significantly more or less than the cost of producing and mailing the stamps, and then we'd adjust them over time so that we're not collecting more money for the handling fee than what it's actually costing.
All right. Representative Hansen, would you like to move this amendment, please?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Hansen moves the A-10-2259 amendment. Any questions, Mr. Bogus, on the amendment? Being none, in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. The chair will move amendments to the following bills, House File 3124, House File 2906 as amended, House File 3227, and House File 3325 to be moved and incorporated into House File 3124. Questions on the amendment? Being none, in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Do we have any more amendments to put it in?
Okay. The chair will renew his motion that House File 3124 be recommended to pass and sent to the Policy on Environment. Representative Eakin, the chair. In favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevailed. We are adjourned.